Welcome to the Veritas Forum.
This is the Veritas Forum podcast,
a place where ideas and beliefs converge.
What I'm really going to be watching is which one has the resources in their worldview to be tolerant, respectful, and humble toward the people they disagree with.
How do we know whether the lives that we're living are meaningful?
If energy, light, gravity, and consciousness are a mystery, don't be surprised if you're going to get an element of this in God.
In today's episode, we hear from Christina Soriano, Associate Provost for the Arts and Interdisciplinary Initiatives, as well as an Associate Professor of Dance at Wake Forest University. We also hear from David Hagee, Orchestra Director at Wake Forest University and Music Director of the Salisbury Symphony, a discussion moderated by the Dean of Wake Forest University, Jonathan Lee Walton, titled The Role of the Arts in a Post-Pandemic World, hosted by the Veritas Forum at Wake Forest University.
I want to offer our first question for consideration. Let's just kind of start big, thinking about how the arts have played a role in finding meaning and perspective during this absurd time in our nation, in our world over the last 14 months. Professor Soriano, how about we begin with you?
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction. Thank you, Veritas Forum, for this opportunity and for the students who organized this event. I'm always so impressed by our students at Wake Forest University, their vision, their focus, even during a pandemic. I feel like I have to start this question by giving everyone a little bit of some background about the impact that the pandemic has had on the arts and the creative industry. So if I may, I may just start there, again, sort of zooming out and then zooming back in. So I'll just speak sort of regionally about arts impacts. I gathered some data from the Americans for the Arts, and some of this content also comes from the Brookings Institute. But the economic impact of the arts and cultural sector to our region has been so significant, as it has been across the world. Prior to the shutdown, a little over a year ago, though, the arts and cultural sector impacted our community in myriad ways, including just imagine pre-pandemic, if you will, 800,000 art experiences annually just in Winston-Salem. Arts enrichment in our public schools in Winston-Salem and Forsyth County, 31,000 students reached. Financially, almost $157 million impact in Forsyth County, which includes almost 5,600 equivalent full-time jobs. So that's pre-pandemic. And then if you look at losses that have happened, again, these are estimates, but are staggering if you hear these numbers. $300 million in lost sales since our shuttered arts nonprofits have been unable to work. $1 billion in total economic impact from these shuttered nonprofits. And then $3.5 billion in lost revenue in North Carolina's creative economy. So those numbers aren't just for this sort of small select group of people who like to call themselves artists. This is our entire region. This is all of us. A lot of times when we think about what it means to thrive in a society, I don't know a world that thrives without art in it. And so I, more than anything, I think this perspective of where we go from here is critical, and how we put the arts in their due place of prominence has to be how we move towards thriving from this point forward. I'll have some more things to say, but I'll stop there for now.
Professor Hagee.
Well, certainly during this crisis of the pandemic, I think the thing we've lost the most, and this is not just arts, this is the world, has lost personal connections. I think the ability to touch someone, the ability to get together and have meaningful discussion, the ability to simply even see others from time to time has been a huge loss. It's driven many of us into depressions, I would think. But the arts are what have helped many of us during this time, thankfully. Sadly, they weren't live arts, which are far more impactful to all of us, but recorded versions, videos, the music that we have, the performances that have been able to be produced online, all of these, all of the various ways in which we can access art have helped us overcome this lack of personal connection. I'd love to be able to play my first example at this point, because I think this is an example of something that, it's a very short example from a work by Haydn. Haydn is a composer of the 18th century, 1732 to 1809, and he wrote this work late in his life, The Creation. And this is his depiction of the creation of the first sunrise. Perfect. Perfect. It leads then to a recitative about in shining splendor, the sun is created. I can't not have hope when I hear that. And it's music like that, and of course, the music speaks to us all differently. Hopefully, that spoke of a very exciting growth of something. But I just can't not have the broadest of smiles in hearing that. So it's the way in which we have used music to bring life back into us. The life that we have missed from not being able to converse and to get together with others.
I might Thank just you. Add, oh, sorry.
No, I was actually going to ask. I mean, thank you for that example of Haydn, Professor Hagee, and also thank you for recognizing just the kind of extraordinary economic impact. We know the astounding numbers as it relates to human life and this loss of personal connection. But I've also heard that, and I know through history has taught us that creativity flourishes during times of despair, and art often gives voice to suffering. And so I was wondering, Professor Soriano, in terms of this thinking about finding meaning and perspective during this time of pandemic, some of the kind of creative flourishings that you've witnessed and seen and or pulled from.
Yeah, thank you. I just have to acknowledge, I was so deeply listening to the Haydn and then I looked over and David, it filled your body, right? I mean, you are a conductor, right?
I cannot not do that. It's the same way I would conduct it.
Well, and that's sort of, I mean, this is, I think, what we all need to acknowledge is that art is something that we experience physically together. And so I just, the idea of returning to a crowded theater someday soon and being next to someone on both sides and that collective moment when the lights go out right before the performance begins is a moment of grace. I mean, it is a moment of awe. It is a moment of possibility. It's a moment of wonder and
mystery.
And a moment we've all been unable to experience, right? And so we find the idea of the spirit of the human condition, right? Like we persevere. Yes, my colleagues in the music department have made their performances online. My colleagues in theater and dance have turned and made plays, radio plays, and have, had events on Davis Field and distanced with, we've done the best we can. And yet when we can all be back in the theater, I feel as though, and in crowded art galleries again, and museum spaces again, I feel as though the barometer that sort of recalibrating will recenter itself for so many of us. And so it starts with a deep belief and trust in science so that we can have those moments, right? We can have those moments and experiences together. I'll say one short quote, which has been my mantra throughout the pandemic, which at the beginning of the pandemic, my children and I would watch Mo Willems, who is a children's book author and the Kennedy Center artist in residence for the Department of Education there. And he held these lunch drawing sessions with children. And he would teach us how to draw his beloved book characters like Pigeon and Gerald the Elephant. And we would do this together online. And at the end of one session, I remember him distinctly saying, "Science is going to get us over this. The arts are going to get us through it." And so back to my moments before where I gave some of those grim numbers, it's on all of us to move through, to move over things with science, and then to acknowledge the way the arts moved us through it, and not forget about those organizations when we return, and not forget all the things that they had to endure. In order to sustain, in order to just survive. So with that, I will now shift to an example. And I want to thank, we're here, David and I are here as artists, like the art is always going to say better what we say as individuals, right? And so I have two short solos, which I don't know if the choreographers were aware of each other's works when they made these two pieces. But I'll start with an excerpt of a work that I studied throughout undergrad and grad school. It is a seminal work in sort of Western dance, modern dance history canon. Both of these works are. I'm going to start with a work by the choreographer Tally Beattie called Mourner's Bench. And I think I'll just show this short excerpt and then give everyone a little bit of context. There's a photo of Beattie at Jacob's Pillow when he premiered the work in 1948. Originally, it's from 1947. And then I'm also going to share some insight from my friend and colleague, Duane Cyrus, who performed this work and also met Beattie. And I interviewed him to sort of get some perspective from him about his experiences dancing the work when he was a member of several different companies in New York. But let's watch this short video excerpt, and then I'll give a little more context about the work historically. Thank you.
Beautiful.
So, brief context. Sorry, we're professors, so we talk a lot about that work. This piece is significant for so many reasons, but I think the other thing is, let's think about being a Black male choreographer in the 1940s and what that experience was. And Beattie's family lived in Louisiana, and his father relocated the family to Chicago after there had been a fight around the sale of land that did not work in the family's favor. And so Beattie is now in Chicago as a young boy, and he's interested in dance, and he has to be in a segregated studio. He cannot be with the other dance students. He is in a separate place trying to learn material and study his craft from this adjacent space, right? So fortunately, this talented, important person in our history went on to dance with Catherine Dunham. So his legacy moves from Catherine Dunham, who is someone who you should learn about if you don't know about Catherine Dunham's work. And when he toured with Catherine Dunham's company in the 40s, commonly the company would not be able to stay in hotels, right? So they would be housed with members of the community who could house them. And other times, if they were housed in hotels, it was like subhuman-like accommodations. And so is it a wonder that a choreographer like Beattie is going to make a work like this? This is from a suite of dances, five parts, called Southern Landscape, which Beattie made in response to a novel by Howard Fast called Southern Landscape. And it's a Reconstruction era book that really talks about these delineated historical contexts and the chain of events that led to an experience not that unsimilar from Beattie's growing up. There was a cooperative community in South Carolina of farmers that the Ku Klux Klan, essentially in this novel, was, they were men on this farm were wrongly accused. And the result is that Black farmers, their farms were burned and many of them were slain. And so Beattie makes this dance, Mourner's Bench. And we know this spiritual, this African-American spiritual, Balm and Gilead, to make the wounded whole. There's power enough in heaven to cure a sin-sick soul. And he uses this song and the movement of this restricted space, this bench, that he is, it is his grief, it is his anchor of his reality. And my friend Dwayne, who's here in this photo, I really wanted to get a first account of his experience dancing this work. And he did this as his jury for dancing for his degree at Juilliard.
Oh, my.
And so Dwayne talks very vividly about the memory of having to negotiate that bench and what that difficulty was, right? Emotionally, physically, spiritually. And he remembered that as a young, like 21-year-old, he said to me, you know, I would have thought grief is this wild, slashing experience where the just mournful wailing. And he says, but I learned, and he also studied again with Beattie, but he learned this dance from one of his mentors named Alfred Gallman. But he said, you know, Beattie was so powerfully reminding us about the entrapment of grief, that to move wildly is not my privilege or my opportunity, but it is a trap. It is one that is slow and sustained, and one that is, I am gripped to this bench. Dwayne remembers the experiences he had, the bruises he had, right? You saw the way this dancer is moving, rolling around the bench. Later in the solo, he has to stand on it with one leg in this very difficult position. He has to promenade on one leg around the bench. And at the end, mournfully shaking off the bench on the floor, he described it mourningly, frightening, and technically negotiating. That was always the balance of this entrapment that he had. So I just finished with this idea too of Who gets to rest? Who gets to grieve? Who gets to acknowledge this pain, and how this tradition of using an African American spiritual like Balm and Gilead juxtaposed with this, how there is still yet somehow miraculously hope, possibility. You see that in the gesturing upwards, in this heavenly way. So this piece is just one that I find profoundly moving and incredibly important for dance history students to study and to know about. I'll pause there.
While tied to the bench, he seems to find a freedom in the course of it. It was really remarkable.
I mean, Professor Soriano, let me just say, I'm just sitting here so moved by the dance and by the image and the fact that you referenced, that you decided to give us this particular example of the mourner's bench. I mean, when we think about what the mourner's bench meant in evangelical culture, I mean, it was where one went to pray, to lament, yet to wait on God, right, toward the end of redemption. Right? And the fact that he's at this mourner's bench, actively lamenting, wailing, right, this is the point for God to show up. While we're hearing this Negro spiritual, there's a balm in Gilead. We know the spirituals giving voice, right, to the pain, to the horror of those living on the underside of the American experiment. And so it's the blues, the spirituals, the Negro spirituals. I once heard Wynton Marcellus actually associated with our conversation. I actually heard Wynton Marcellus once describe the spirituals and the blues like a vaccine. It's giving a controlled dose of suffering and embracing that toward being able to inoculate oneself from nihilism and giving way to grief.
Well put.
So this kind of, that was the imagery that was coming to me as you showed that video and as you were describing it. So, and so that actually leads to another question that I have in terms of, because this is just such a great example of what art can teach us, right, about things such as grief, lament. But also we've heard, for example, Professor Hagee, you talked about hope, right, happiness, joy. I was wondering if you could help us think a little bit about art's role in teaching us how to both express and deal with the range of emotions in life.
Do you want me to address that?
Please, please.
I think the majority of people tend to use the arts for the hope side, for the positive side, for the very visceral, giving me energy, giving me hope, giving me excitement, giving me all sorts of the positive emotions. And this is always a difficult issue for example, with me and Salisbury. What do I present on a concert? Do I make them all feel very happy throughout the whole concert, or do I help them share a depth of lower emotion and help them bring it through, which is very much like, I love that Wynton Marsalis quote of a vaccine, because it gives you a little bit of the pain of a situation so that you might possibly deal with the exterior grander pain and keep it out of you. That's really beautiful. So I walk a balance as I try to present programming. I can remember a time when we presented a country western star with the orchestra, and that was all going to be very fun. But on the program, which was for children, I also presented the Lucas Voss piece about Anne Frank. And here we had people who were there to hoot and holler and celebrate country music. And they sat through an 8-minute work on the difficulty of Anne Frank. And, you know, I got many comments from them about that program. Wow, that's not a piece that I would have listened to, but boy, that made a difference. We have to have the braveness to really seek out the artwork that exposes our pain. And in the long run, it helps us through it. But it's not easy necessarily. It's much easier to go see the pieces that we know we're going to come out of the theater whistling and being happy with, and the artwork and the dance and any of that that we know helps us feel good about ourselves. So it's the arts can do all of this. That's what's so amazing. The arts can take us through the depth of despair, through the height of hope, and through actually mundane life, through all sorts of different emotions, and just to help us maybe experience them with greater depth. That's what I love. Christine?
Let me just say, I appreciate the image of the audience being arrested by the Anne Frank priest and being forced to deal, because so often there is a kind of inclination to just want to use art to just to feel good, right? To be soothed,
of course,
to be comforted, right? But there's actually a comforting that actually can be found in the pain and the tragedy of life. Right? But often from varying privileged perspectives, we don't embrace that. The author, the great man of letters, James Baldwin, he actually said that's why the privileged class often doesn't understand gospel music, because they think happy songs are supposed to be sung happy and sad songs are supposed to be sung sad, rather than gospel music is actually inverse. It's actually singing a song with the grief and lament in the voice, and therefore one sings oneself happy in the process.
Well, and it comes from the fact that the people who created it had to find some happiness somewhere. And so they made it for themselves from that music. And it's just amazing.
Now, ain't that the gospel truth? Professor Soriano.
Yeah, I'm realizing as a choreographer, right, my job is to arrange bodies in space and to make sense of what that can tell, what that story or what that experience is. And I'm realizing that these examples that I have put together all carry together this idea of a bench and the relationship that we have to, in religious spaces and spiritual places, what we have to that bench. And really, the summative concept is contemplation, is reflection. It is prayer, right? There are many ways that we can come to this arrival of the bench and its role. And I so appreciate what you said, but really it's about being together with people too, right? Seated in that space together. So I'd love to just show this quick, short excerpt of another artist, Martha Graham's representation of this concept of grief, right? And so this work, Lamentation, from 1930. Again, I don't know if Graham and Beattie knew one another or knew of each other's work, but this work, Lamentation, from 1930, Graham called the personification of grief itself. It's not about a specific person or a time or place, but of this universal idea of grief itself. And you'll notice the dancer is wearing this long tube, which obsesses the body. And the dancer, again, like Beattie's Mourner's Bench, the dancer is unable to stretch inside it. So the grief is really sort of all encompassing. It's set to a score by Codaly from 1910, a piano piece, Opus 3, number 2. This is a short excerpt of Lamentation. Thinking about the bench again, and then I'm excited to move to, I do have some happier thoughts that aren't just around grief, But I do want to live in that for just a moment longer, because I think it's important to acknowledge that we've all been grieving a lot in the last 14 months. Thank you. That ending moment too, where she just sort of comes in on herself, is such a powerful sort of subsuming of it.
Confinement.
Yeah. I think you're spot on with that. I will say too, though, that what the body endures is pretty powerful. What the body is capable of doing. So I want to celebrate the body, and I want to celebrate that the performativity of the body and the way we've seen bodies in the world, the way we've seen Black bodies at the hands of police in the last several months, well, and decades and centuries before that. But I don't watch dances anymore without thinking about the last year and a half. It's become something I think that is critical to just say out loud for all of us to acknowledge that. It's with dancers, our bodies are everything. And so when we witness bodies and the pain that they have endured, the killing that they have endured, it is really hard to also not look to art to help us make sense of it all. So... But I do want to also go back to your question, because I feel like I strayed a little there, but I do want to address.
So, well, you're referring now to suffering. I mean, you're referring to grief, mourning, suffering, the articulation and expression of violence, which particularly in the Christian tradition is encoded in all of the varying rituals of the church, particularly as we. Whether it's the Lord's Supper, for example, acknowledging the crucifixion, state-sanctioned murder, violence, destruction of a body, that we partake of the body and the blood as in remembrance of that price that was paid.
Yeah. This is what I love about conversations with colleagues. You learn so much about one another through the things that you've studied and the lenses through which you make sense of the world. So thank you for doing that with music, David, and through the lens of a divinity professor's perspective. And we all come to it and arrive, I think, at a very similar place.
But from very different perspectives. My mother would, I would often say to my mother when some television show was on, oh, listen to that. Can you hear how emotional that is? And she'd go, what? She didn't ever hear it. And she'd say to me, oh, look at that. That's incredibly beautiful. Do you see how that's? And I go, what? Because I hear it. I experience the world through my ears more than my eyes. And my mother experienced it much more through her eyes than her ears. So I know we all come to the arts with different backgrounds and even different bodies and perceptions from our own bodies. But still, I think these artworks share something that reaches me with different aesthetic without a God. They reach you with an aesthetic with a God. They all speak to us, perhaps with a different leaning, but they still help us experience our lives.
Well, as we think about this experience and we think about loss as well as hope, I'm interested to know, in terms of your view on the arts moving forward, as we think about return to normalcy, what do you imagine the arts will look like in our new normal post-pandemic?
Me?
Please.
All right. I expect first that they're going to try to seek what was there before. I think we're going to want to see getting together in large groups, experiencing large things. I think there's going to be, over the next year, a desire to do the grandest of artworks, simply because finally we can, which is unbelievable. But the one change that this world has created, I mean, we are exemplifying that change. Before February, I wonder how many people knew the word Zoom. I don't think very many people knew it. At this point, it is now a verb in our society. Have you Zoomed yet lately with that, on that topic? Or the arts have attacked online. Some were there before the pandemic, but they were forced there by the pandemic. And I think that at least an availability to them online is going to remain. Whether or not orchestra performances, theater performances, dance performances will all be available online, streamed at some point, I doubt that they all will, but a significantly larger portion than before the pandemic will be available to a wider disbursement of population, both to the country and to the world, for that matter. I'm always amazed by the thought of, we just put the orchestra's March concert online this week. It's on there until Sunday. And someone could, in southern China, go listen to that performance and perhaps hear one of their children, because we have Chinese students in the orchestra, hear the performance that never could have possibly heard that performance before. So that's one change. It's going to expand, I think, the reach that arts have.
Thank you. You're right. Zoom is, I heard somewhere, Zoom is like faith. It's a noun, it's a verb, it's an adjective, it's ubiquitous, omnipresent, omniscient, it's all encompassing.
Exactly.
Professor Soriano.
Well, I want to think about some of those places where we can come together. That's what I want to look forward to. And I will say there is a space that I am dying to visit. I have never been, but it is in Houston, Texas. It is the Rothko Chapel, which I think I have a couple of quick slides to share. No video this time, just images. But I'm drawn to this space because of its design and its mission and purpose. So the Rothko Chapel was built between 1964 and 1971. It is its 50th anniversary right now. Oh. And what I, just to quote some language from the website, and also some text about the Rothko Chapel, is a place where art is capable of inducing spiritual reactions in the people who encounter it. Over 100,000 people have visited it regularly pre-pandemic. And it was constructed by the vision of incredible art philanthropists and really city leaders in Houston, John and Dominique DeMille. And they work cooperatively with Rothko and the architect Philip Johnson to create a space that would express the profound and miraculous regard and sanctity for the human spirit. The idea that it is also a space with an unwavering commitment to social justice. There is this work here, the sculpture to the right at the top is a Barnett Newman's Broken Obelisk, which was dedicated to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. This was in 1969, I believe, or maybe it was 1970. Of course, King died in 68. And so having this image there as you approach this chapel, and this at the bottom is a little bit about what it looks like, right? This space with these very Rothko-like paintings. There are 14 in there. They are different shades of black. And what the sanctuary for the seeker is a place you sit at these pews that are movable. There are many different spiritual traditions and their texts there, or you are there in solitude and you just experience the wash of these Rothko 14, like either triptychs or individual pieces, while you have this light streaming into from above. It just sounds like a place I need to visit. Mm-hmm. A worship memorial to a great leader, to Dr. King. A place where spiritual life and action can come together, right? How we contemplate what we then go out and do in the world. Wholeness, oneness, we need these ideas, these ideals, these actions, these practices. Super fast, I'll just go quickly to about, next slide, please. So these are some more of Rothko works. This work by Rothko, that light over red, black, is familiar. I remember visiting the Tate and sitting as a 20-year-old looking at Rothko pieces and just becoming overwhelmed. It was like this mirror and yet also this depth where I just sort of dove in and thought about my life. And as a 20-year-old, to sit and look at a painting for more than 30 seconds is not something that I had experienced. And so sitting for a profound amount of time and having art have that impact on me, Rothko remains one of the most important artists, I think, in the second half of the 20th century in our art history canon. And then I'll just say, you know, a place that was so dedicated to programs like these are events that are taking place in the chapel. I want to be there. I want to be a part of where these kinds of practices and also acceptance and celebration of many faith traditions or no faith traditions happening in a space dedicated to art feels right to me. Feels right in our reset.
Thank you so much, Professor Soriano. Professor Hagee, Professor Soriano, we would like to now turn to a few questions from our audience. These are questions that are coming in through Slido. I'm going to check into the chat box to capture a couple. And we actually have the first one is for you, Dr. Hagee. A questioner says that you mentioned the Anne Frank piece with the audience. How do we expose different forms of art to people from different backgrounds?
Well, that particular concert was one way in which I did it. That concert featured I don't want to give the name, but a well-known race car driver who narrated and sang and on our concert. We had very purposefully tried to establish a male athlete, which I think race car drivers are athletes, that we wanted to have as a guest on our family concert to try to bring younger males who might think that classical music is not very male and not the best of things. So we did that very purposefully, and we got a much larger audience. His large number of his following, race car following, came to the concert, and they heard that Anne Frank piece. That's how you do it. You pair in meaningful ways. The concert was all about heroes and heroines. And the songs and the narration that the race car driver gave were about more well-known heroes and heroines. But this then provided a picture of a heroine that and a somewhat bleak one that we allowed a high school young lady to narrate, because that presented the view of Anne Frank literally, a more identifiable view. You have to combine, make programs of positive works and let them be the end and let them leave, or rarely do a whole program that really you leave kind of confounded and dumbfounded by the depth. I do occasionally do those, but it's difficult.
Thank you. Professor Soriano, in your role as Associate Provost over the Arts, this is something that seems that you have to do. That is to say, exposing different forms of art to different backgrounds. If you could discuss some of your approaches or strategies in your role at Wake Forest.
Well, I will say that our idea that Wake Forest is a place where the arts belong to everybody has to be how we live our truth. So the notion of pro humanitate through every facet of a Wake Forest experience absolutely lives in Scales Fine Arts Center, but it can't only live there. The arts really can be a part of every student experience, whether they are a student in the Divinity School or an undergraduate who's a music major, who's been in the orchestra all 4 years with Dr. Hagee, a dancer in our dance program, a student in the business school. I think my idea that, it's not even my idea, it's just a human idea that we can all have meaningful, no, even better, transformative experiences in the arts during our time at Wake Forest should be everyone's experience. And so how does that happen? It's aligning and finding partners who want to support that, and it's a lot of listening to other people and their vision for that. So I often actually think about your wisdom, Dean Walton, when you talk about how someone encounters a space and if they feel as though they belong there or not has to do with perhaps what's on the walls. And so the ways that we create, the way that art can be a tool, your term, I love this notion of ambient belonging, right? That I walk in, if I am a person of a certain faith and I walk into a space that doesn't have images that represent me or my experiences, how do I know that this space or place is for me? So that's one example. It's finding ways that there are people who, there are colleagues, there are students who agree and want to work towards finding those transformational experiences and knowing that they might not just be on a stage, right? But that they might be on the pew of a church, or they might be in the middle of a public space that is shared by many, right? A shared space on campus somewhere or outdoors. So I think that it is a lifelong pursuit, and I've really enjoyed the way this position gives me an opportunity to meet people who might not otherwise be someone I would regularly encounter.
I'd like to address that a little bit before we leave the subject, because I think that the arts are something that can be off-putting. And not seen as inclusive when they're not meant that way. I think, for example, classical music. I hear more people say, oh, well, I don't know very much about classical music. Fine. Come hear something and see if it addresses you. You don't have to know anything. I don't know enough about art to appreciate fine art. You don't have to know anything about art. Maybe an educated view might experience more depth to an artwork, but that's not to say that an uneducated view won't experience depth at all, and always will. I'm not good enough to play in that orchestra. Who cares how good you are if you come with an open thought about, yes, we want to make you better. We want to hope that you can contribute to our performance. But so many people are afraid in this day and age to even try to be an artist. And being an artist can be whistling or singing in the shower. It can be any way of being involved in making music, making visual representations, making moving through your space daily. As John Cage said, everything you do is music, and everywhere you sit is the best seat. That's it.
You know, but it takes courage.
It does. It takes courage.
Students on this call, like those of you that have had the courage to study art at Wake Forest, thank you. Like, risk taking is what we do, right? We're taking risks. We're showing up on the line vulnerably, putting ourselves out there in our art making, and also in our critical review of art, right? Those of us that are scholars, that risk that we take is so important. And so I think that's the other thing that I've been really excited to talk about more in terms of why the arts matter and why they matter at Wake Forest during your experience. They matter because it's a moment to put yourself on the line and take a risk and fail beautifully, you know, fail powerfully. And then the resilience of getting back up and trying it again. You know, art is also daily, right? It's another thing I think often, I was thinking a lot about. There's so many ways to come into this topic about the arts, right? The dailiness, when we think about spiritual practice, that the artistic practice, the dailiness of it, right? I think about that a lot too. So thank you for taking the risk.
You know, to hear you talk about the dailiness of it, right? Or how art shows up in so many spaces. And you're really talking about, as Professor Hage was pointing to, a kind of democratization of the art, right? Of art, in so far as we're disrupting the hierarchies that become exclusive when we think about high culture and low culture, right? And the ways that we kind of categorize in exclusive ways. And so we think about the symphony maybe differently than we think about contemporary gospel music that's sung in many of our churches. So we think about Chopin differently than we think about the genius or brilliance of an Aretha Franklin or Fantasia. Right. And so what you're describing now is this kind of democratization that culture can take so many different forms. Art takes so many different forms. And with that in mind, we actually have a question about how can we continue or even do a better job of offering accessibility to the arts as it relates to equitably providing experiences to those who might not be able to afford them, and or to Dr. Hage's point, may feel that they don't belong.
Well, first it's being brave, as Christina says, to have the courage to feel I do belong. Just say, I do belong, and
but I can prompt. Feel I can feel like I belong, and I can know I belong, and I can still feel unwanted.
Yes, that's sadly the case in certain situations.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's important to acknowledge, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think we have to acknowledge that. We constantly, certainly in the symphonic world, acknowledge how are we being closed-minded? How are we saying, no, that's not appropriate? How are we putting off potential audience members? It's a difficult situation because a lot of music, a lot of sound that we want to experience and that has a subtlety to it requires a respect for silence in a way. And in our modern day most popular musical experiences, that silence is not called for in our biggest art. Rock music doesn't require silence to be heard and to be experienced over. And in fact, those rock musicians perhaps would prefer to have an audience yelling and pushing them forward. But some orchestral pieces can't happen with that kind of sound. We have to be prepared to experience art in the way that the creator of it might have had in mind. And that's difficult for some people. But then different arts tend to impact different people. We would like to think that all art can impact all of us. And I think that's true, but it takes a person whose background is in classical music, a boldness to go hear some rock music, some gospel music, some country western music, all of the various styles. And it takes, just as it takes the courage from those people whose background is much more in the popular vein to come to a concert. Do I have to dress up? Oh my, there's so many things that can be barriers. No, you don't have to dress up. We fight these barriers all the time.
Thank you, Professor Soriano.
Well, gosh, there's so many ways to answer this. I mean, I'll start with, historically, when you look at students studying dance in higher ed, at a place like Wake Forest, at a place that maybe has also a BFA program, so we're schools that are training dancers to move on into professions in the arts, in dance. Well, you used the word access. And so I start by saying there is such rigor and beauty and power in the performance of training in a dance studio. And that was my training, and I would never trade any of that for, you know, I wouldn't change anything. That said, when I meet students who, and this happened to me, I remember being at an open house for accepted students and meeting a student who came up to me and said, I just wanted to say hi. I was really looking forward to taking your class, but my parents won't let me take dance at Wake Forest because it's too expensive to go to school here. And I can't, they can't justify that however many credits of this experience financially are worth that time in the studio.
We get that in music too.
Well, and of course, my first reaction is, where is your mother or father who I need to speak to right now?
Exactly.
That wasn't possible. Instead, I said, thank you for saying hello. If I can help you or anyone in your family, like, change your mind, I'm here. I'm here for you, right, to talk about this. But I think the other thing is why we study art, the outcome is not necessarily going to be about access to this position in a dance company. That those touring companies, I can count on one hand now. there is not the same resource. So it is up to us as arts educators to help our students understand that this training is not relegated only to one thing, but it can be that thing. However, there are so many paths that this training can provide for you in your professional lives, in your professional experience, and the worthiness and the beauty of studying this thing that you are passionate about is just as important should you be studying a humanity, a social science, or a STEM-related field. So I think a lot about like the narrative around the arts being this fluffy thing that is just is not necessary, but it's nice. Like, there's got to be a way we do a better job about, no, this is necessary. And it's necessary for all facets of your professional, personal, emotional, spiritual life moving forward. Financial, right? All of the things that matter.
Let me actually keep pushing you. If I can keep pushing you in that direction, because one of the questions that came in was, what are the tangible ways that college students can use the arts for pro humanitate? Right. And so I want to keep pushing you in that direction to specifically answer that question, because I see where you were headed.
Yeah. Well, I want to acknowledge, too, I think about some of the work that have happened in the arts at Wake Forest this year during a pandemic in the spirit of Pro Humanitate. And I think of our colleagues in music and their students who have been offering instruction to Winston-Salem Forsyth County school students with musical instruments because
there's musical empowerment, it's called.
Yeah, the musical empowerment program. So I think about that. I think about my students this semester who've had a residency virtually with sixth graders at Wiley Middle School, where we've been using dance to help sixth graders learn science curriculum and science topics. I think about the way our students have had virtual online art exhibitions available and open to students. I think about the webinars. I think about the way students tomorrow night are going to be revealing works that they have purchased from the Student Union Art Acquisition Fund to join the university art collection, sharing the voices and the artworks of 9 artists, all of whom are underrepresented artists in the art markets, in the art world. So the ways that these experiences are lived and have been happening at Wake Forest, I am so proud of these moments that enliven Pro Humanitate. But it doesn't just start and stop with these sort of community facing things. It has to also be embedded in, I think, a lifelong pursuit of what makes you happy? What brings you joy? Where do you find your passion? How do you identify who you are and what you care about? How can the arts be a vehicle for helping understand? It's the big questions. It's no different than the faith-based questions, right? How it is a part of the human condition. That's what we teach. That's what we're instructing.
Professor Hayes.
As your cat I saw in the corner,
yes.
David was agreeing with his or her tail.
Yes, the tail is here. I'm not sure how they can necessarily jump in and help the arts be for humanity. I think that arts serve the people who try to carry them out as much as the people for whom they are carried out. So the performer benefits as much as the audience member. Be an audience member. That's using the arts. That's helping the performer understand their art form. Or if you really want to help, then volunteer for a group. And there are always things that artists need done, inevitably. I think simply seeking out art, any one art that particularly might intrigue you, and trying to see what it has to offer you is a step pro humanitate.
If you like this and you want to hear more, like, share, review, and subscribe to this podcast. And from all of us here at the Veritas Forum, thank you.